from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tuesday is the federal deadline for states to certify their election results, but court cases remain in Pennsylvania as Green Party candidate Jill Stein has raised questions about the security of the voting process and the possibility of hacking.
These claims that have been brought about some unknown foreign government somehow hacking our machines simply because the pre-election day polls showed that Hillary Clinton was going to win is not only absurd, but it is an insult to the American electorate.
We'll discuss recounts and recanvassing of votes. Also on today's show, the Auditor General says some municipalities in the Commonwealth are misusing revenues from the drilling impact fees. That's ahead on our weekly news roundup. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. WESA's weekly news roundup. I'm Kevin Gavin. Coming up, an audit finds a misuse of drilling impact fee revenues by some municipalities, including for fireworks and celebrations. And the news story 75 years ago in Pittsburgh, across the country, and around the world for that matter, the attack on Pearl Harbor. But first, we've been hearing a couple of words frequently in the past few weeks regarding the election of Donald Trump as president of the United States. Recount and recanvass, and it's happening here in Pennsylvania. Let's talk about that with Dave Davies from our sister station, WHYY in Philadelphia, where a lot of that court action is taking place. Dave, welcome.
Great to be with you, Kevin.
And joining us in studio is Pittsburgh Tribune Review reporter Tom Fontaine. Welcome back to the show, Tom.
All right, thanks for having me.
Okay, let's start with the terminology, guys. The difference between a recount and a recanvass.
Well, in Allegheny County, for instance, and I believe in Philadelphia as well, many of the counties across the state, with the electronic voting machines, they don't produce a paper ballot that you would recount by hand. So the recanvass process, they compare the election night results that are spit out that night with data that's stored in the voting machines, memory flashcards, basically. So you're getting basically like rerunning the results again and seeing if they compare and measure up the same way. And when they did that in Allegheny County, there was no discrepancy in any of the votes. The recanvass showed the same results a few weeks later that they did on election night.
Dave, is there any recanvassing going on at all in the Philly area in eastern Pennsylvania?
Sure there is. I mean, the Stein campaign launched sort of a multi-front offensive in their effort to get the Pennsylvania vote overturned or recounted. And one of the things they did was they recruited several hundred of their supporters to file individual petitions for a recount in their home precinct, just the home precinct, because there is this provision in the state election code that says if three voters petition for it, sign an affidavit, the election board pretty much has to grant it if it's timely filed. And that was done in various counties, and so a number of those recounts or recanvasses have been occurring in the Philadelphia area. There were 75 precincts in Philadelphia, which is about 4% of the total. This was never intended to amount to a statewide recount. It's just sort of impractical. The hope of the Stein people was that when these local recounts occurred, they would discover some discrepancies which would lend some credence to their bigger, broader, scarier argument, which is there's the prospect that the entire state could have been subject, election could have been subject to cyber hacking by a foreign power, read Russia. They needed to get to the courts to believe that could happen, to allow them to do the kind of recount they want, which involves a forensic audit of all the computer stuff. But yeah, there have been some recanvasses here in the Philadelphia area. None of them have turned up any significant discrepancies.
As Tom mentioned, Allegheny County did the recanvassing Monday of this week. Let's hear from the elections director, Mark Wolosik.
The pre-election and post-election election day testing we do, in our mind, we do software verification already, and we've been doing that since the November 2006 election.
Tom, this was a pretty quick process here in Allegheny County. Less than an hour?
Yeah, 45 minutes. It was a very seamless process. You know, it's not very complicated. So, yeah, they were done in under an hour.
And he said there was nothing that wasn't kosher, I guess.
Right. There were no votes. None of the tallies changed. And this, in Allegheny County, it was in 52 precincts. And Allegheny County has 1,322 of them. So it was a small fraction of the county's precincts.
Okay. I want both of you to answer this, if you would. Now, here in Allegheny County, I understand the Green Party representatives were not pleased. And Tom, let's start with you. And Dave, was that the same case in the Philly area as well? Tom?
Yeah. They certainly were not pleased. And what happened in Philadelphia, for example, was that they actually went and looked at the machines for 75 precincts, which are stored in a warehouse. And that was, you know, a bit of a time-consuming process because they had to find the machines and then take a look at them. And then what they did was essentially confirm that the results that were reported on election night are indeed the returns reflected on each individual machine. But this left the Stein campaign really unhappy because their argument is, well, of course they're going to be the same results, because if, in fact, the Russians hacked them, then you're going to get the same bad results. And the only way to discover if something nefarious had occurred would be is if you let their computer experts do imaging of the computer software in the machines and in the tabulating equipment. Let their computer experts take them home to their labs and perform this forensic analysis. They might find digital footprints of hacking, and then maybe you might get a very different total. But that simply looking at the machines or the tallies that were on election night and confirming them is not going to get to the matter. This is an argument that the Stein campaign has made in many different local courts, was going to make in Commonwealth Court, and they're going to make it in federal court. The problem they have is they just the courts want to see some evidence that this might have occurred, and they just really haven't been able to produce it.
Yeah, and that's exactly what happened here. The Stein campaign was asking for the so-called forensic audit of the 4,000 machines here, and then on Thursday afternoon, a county court judge rejected their request to grant this examination. And, you know, Stein's attorneys had argued that she had a statutory right to examine these machines to determine if they were working properly or tampered with. And, you know, the judge said, hey, look, there was no evidence of any voting irregularities, and she couldn't show why she did have a statutory authority to examine these machines. It's also important to note that the county elections director is not required by law to do so, but they conduct a forensic audit prior to the election of a randomly selected machines and found no evidence of tampering or malfunctioning at that time. Now, that doesn't necessarily please Stein's campaign, though.
One of the interesting things about this case is that it turns out the election code does permit a party in a recount to, quote, examine, unquote, a machine. And the argument in a lot of these courts came down to, well, what does that actually mean? What does the term examine mean? And what the Stein folks says is it doesn't mean watching somebody read the numbers off the back. Examine means you open up the machine, get to the heart of the matter, get to the software, see if it's corrupted, see if there's funny code in there. That's an examination. And they had a pretty liberal judge in Philadelphia to make that case to, and she looked at it, and it turned them down. And I really believe if they had had some evidence, to some reason to believe something might have happened, I think she might have been inclined, because you can argue there's room in the state election code to grant that right, but they're just, I don't think they were prepared to do that. It would be quite an undertaking, would might conceivably delay certification of returns, could conceivably delay the state's ability to select its representatives to the Electoral College, and they just weren't going to go there, I think, unless there were some harder evidence.
Now, there's been a lot of court action or decisions. And over the weekend, Dave, we heard that the Stein campaign was withdrawing their case because of the cost of a $1 million bond. Is that the case?
Right. That's what they said. This was actually a separate legal action from what these little petitions in the precincts, what I call the baby recounts. This is a different provision of the code where you says you can formally contest the election result. And to do that, you need the affidavits of 100 voters. They found 100 voters. They made their case. But they were going to go into Commonwealth Court and make the same argument we've been discussing. Yes, these machines are vulnerable to hacking. There's been foreign interference in the election so far. You know, state voter databases in Illinois and Arizona were hacked. Thus, it could have happened here. And the court, partially at the prodding of the Republican opponents, the court said, well, we want to see a $1 million bond before we proceed. And I think the Stein campaign looked at the money and looked at the odds and said, never mind, we're going to go to a federal court and make a different argument.
Yeah, and on the way out, they also called Pennsylvania's election system a national disgrace. So, you know, but they did go the federal route, that's sure.
We're talking about the request for a recount in Pennsylvania on the Confluence with Dave Davies from our sister station WHYY in Philadelphia and Tribune Review reporter Tom Fontaine. Let's back up. Jill Stein said the purpose behind these actions was, quote, to ensure our votes are safe and secure, end quote. During the campaign, Donald Trump said that if he lost this state or that state, and he did mention Pennsylvania, it would be due to election fraud. Dave, you and Tom and I, we all did stories on whether the system was secure when these comments, suggestions that Mr. Trump was making came out. Did any of you get any hint that there was really questions about the security of this voting process? We'll start with you, Dave.
No. I mean, our elections are run mostly by neighborhood volunteers who kind of take the system together and put it together twice a year. There were 9,000 polling places in Pennsylvania. So there are always going to be some hitches and problems. But I've never believed that there's any, you know, widespread fraud by Democrats who, you know, get illegal aliens or bring buses full of unregistered voters in to do things. And I've never believed at the same time that there's this massive Republican voter suppression effort that goes in the neighborhoods and intimidates minorities or students or others. It, you know, things like that happen in small places on occasion. But in the main, I think the system works pretty well. Cyber hacking is a different matter. I mean, I think you can make a case that a lot of these voting systems aren't as secure as they should be. They're 20 years old. On the other hand, I mean, to successfully hack them would be a huge, very sophisticated operation. You know, maybe the Russian intelligence would be up to it, but I think to kind of turn things upside down and do a massive recount on the presumption that it may have happened, it's just a little hard for the courts to swallow it.
I would agree with that. And, you know, I mean, it's maybe something to look forward to future elections to maybe determine a way that they can provide maybe more security for these systems and so forth. But again, as you're saying, there are no indications of widespread voter fraud. Even in the hiccups that occurred here in Allegheny County, I think there were 115 emergency ballots that had to be cast because maybe an election judge didn't show up to a precinct or something along those lines. There were more than 600,000 votes cast in Allegheny County. So, I mean, it's a small, small fraction.
So let's listen to Jill Stein's attorney, Ilan Mazel, and Lawrence Tabus. He's the attorney for the Republican Party. This is after the petition was filed in federal court Monday.
The basic thrust of our case is that we have machines we can't trust, we have documented foreign interference in the election, and we need to get to the truth.
They weren't able to show any potential issue whatsoever with respect to the machines in Pennsylvania.
So, Dave, picking up on what you said, it would require a huge, sophisticated effort. First of all, we're talking, I believe, about the direct recording electronic machines. Are these machines online that you can just sort of hack? Or would you have to do them individually? How could this be done?
Well, there are a couple of different ideas. I mean, the defenders of the system make the point that they are not connected to the Internet. So it would be like hacking a toaster. You know, the Stein experts say it's immaterial whether or not they are connected to the Internet. What they say is, like, take you have a big county like Allegheny or Philadelphia where you have, you know, thousands of voting machines in a warehouse. At some point before every election, they have to be programmed with the new ballot and the new candidate. Somebody somewhere is going to make some new software, and that's going to be inserted into those machines so they can conduct that current election. And the argument is, you know, that's conducted in a probably not terribly secure county office somewhere. And if somebody could get in there, it's not that hard to devise computer code which would allow the machines to pass the pre-election inspection and then on election day shave just enough to votes to make a difference, but not so many as to be obvious, and then erase its tracks at the end of the day. That's their theory. It doesn't matter whether the machines themselves are connected to the Internet. And I will say, you can read this affidavit, you know, at my blog at newsworks.org or a lot of places, and it's the kind of thing where you come into it thinking, oh, come on. And by the time you get to the end, you think, I don't know, maybe. But there's just no particular reason to think it might have happened here. And again, I just come back to that again and again. That's the problem the Stein lawyers face, is they just need some evidence to present.
I was just saying, yeah, I have read these same complaints and affidavits, and yeah, they do plant a seed of doubt in your mind once you finish reading them. And, you know, many of these experts that have Jill Stein has consulted, you know, maybe you bring them in, the election commission or some sort of commission and could be formed to really take a close look at this going into certainly before the next presidential election. I don't know. But yeah, I would agree wholeheartedly that you kind of walk away from some of these things thinking, well, you know, there's a possibility.
Yeah, I think Tom makes a really good point that prospectively, I mean, for future elections, it would really be smart to have changing the direction of government is not easy. There are procurement rules, but people ought to start now in updating these things, making them more secure and sophisticated and probably more uniform. It's such a patchwork in every state. That would be a goal, I think, for future elections.
So to both of you, I'm curious, has the Stein campaign said why Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and why not a Texas or a South Carolina? In other words, states that traditionally go Republican?
Well, what they had said is, they didn't make it an issue of electoral votes and the fact that these states did swing the election in many respects. They said that the machines that are used in those states are the most vulnerable for attack, for problems, and that the election systems themselves, the broader infrastructure by which elections are held and run, are out of date and are rife for potential problems. So I know Jill Stein has been very critical, highly critical of the system that we have here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, you know, I think what the Stein campaign is really up to is just a fascinating subject of a lot of speculation. I mean, there are people who say, well, she feels terrible about kind of taking votes away from Hillary Clinton and putting Donald Trump in the White House, and now she wants to see what she can do to undo that. I've heard other people say that, you know, this isn't partly about money. I mean, consultants and lawyers making a fortune from all these actions, and about giving the Green Party more national visibility. I have no idea, but it's certainly generated a lot of legal action that, at least in Pennsylvania, probably isn't going to get us anywhere.
And if that were the case, too, you know, and that's a very likely possibility that they wanted to raise their profile. But, you know, just informally, anecdotally, I feel like there is some level of fatigue that has grown over these past 2 weeks as this thing has dragged on multiple fronts in multiple states. I think people have, they are not necessarily excited about a Donald Trump presidency, they've come to terms with the fact that he is going to be our next president.
Quickly to both of you gentlemen, what's next in courts?
Well, there'll be a hearing in federal court in Philadelphia, and the Stein campaign is going to have to make a case not just that computers could be hacked, but that the election system in Philadelphia is so inept and unfair that it is a violation of the U.S. Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause, the First Amendment. They're going to have to try and convince a judge that our system is so bad that it violates the Constitution, and then make the case that we need to open up the machines and look for evidence of hacking.
Any sense that a decision would happen quickly there, or a ruling on that request?
I think everybody understands it's got to move quickly because of the deadlines for choosing the electors. I mean, our representatives to the Electoral College are supposed to be selected by, what, next Tuesday, I think? And I think most of the folks that I talk to think that this judge is going to move quickly and probably swiftly dismiss the Green Party action. He was appointed by George W. Bush in 2004, kind of leans conservative. But, you know, courts can always surprise you. We'll see how it plays out.
And in Allegheny County, Tom?
Yeah, on Monday, the County Elections Board is to meet, and they are expected to certify their results formally a day ahead of the federal deadline.
Tom Fontaine is a reporter for the Tribune Review. Dave Davies, a reporter for WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure.
Coming up, Pennsylvania's Auditor General says some municipalities are not spending impact fee revenues as intended on infrastructure repairs and environmental programs. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. As you heard on What's Trending, Pennsylvania's Auditor General reported this week that counties and municipalities in the state mishandled millions of dollars in drilling impact fee revenues. Joining us to discuss that and the DEP's release of a proposal to limit methane emissions, Marie Cusick, reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Marie.
Thanks for having me.
And in studio is Reid Frazier, reporter with the Allegheny Front. Reid, welcome to you.
Hi, Kevin.
If you have a question or comment, you can tweet us at WESA Confluence.
Where we are seeing a problem with the spending is when local governments fail to connect the expenditures to the oil and gas industry drilling activity.
That was Auditor General Eugene DePasquale. So let me ask the two of you, was this a planned regular audit, or was there something that caught the Auditor General's attention to do that study? Marie, we'll start with you.
Yeah, well, no, nothing really came up as a huge red flag. What happened was this law creating the impact fees for gas drilling was passed in 2012. So there were some questions over the years about particular expenditures, but the Auditor General's office just felt like, you know, we have a few years now of data to go over, and that's why they wanted to take a look at it.
And, you know, if you'll recall, the impact fee, just to kind of go back, was a per well fee that the Republican legislature was favored over a severance tax, which would have been, by some estimates, more money. And the structure of the impact fee was that a certain amount would go to the counties and the municipalities where the drilling actually takes place. So it wasn't just going to go into the general fund so that every Pennsylvanian could sort of draw equally from those funds, but that they're really going, you know, in this case, to places like Washington County, where there's just been a lot of drilling.
Let's go back a bit, as the two of you alluded to. It was February 2012, then Governor Corbett, although he opposed the severance tax on Marcellus Shale gas, did sign legislation establishing the impact fee. Now, didn't this legislation give the revenue recipients, whether they're requirements or were they guidelines, how to use this money they were getting?
Yeah, that's right. There were, in the law, there are 13 different ways that counties and municipalities are allowed to spend this money. And it's things like public infrastructure improvements, emergency preparedness, affordable housing, judicial services, environmental programs. And the idea was that these this money would help mitigate the negative consequences associated with the gas boom, things like, you know, increases in crime and housing shortages. But really what the audit found was there's a lack of clarity in the law about those 13 spending categories, and there's also a weak system of financial reporting. So this isn't necessarily a story of some, you know, nefarious local officials doing embezzling money or anything. It's just that what the audit found was, in many cases, they didn't think that those spending categories were clear enough, and the money was going to things like, you know, community celebration. The Auditor General brought up North Strabane Township in Washington County, which spent some of the money on this party they have every year, and they spent it on fireworks and a bouncy house and an appearance by a former American Idol contestant. So the Auditor General said he's pro people having fun, but he just doesn't believe that impact fees should be spent that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when people first, when the impact fee first came around, it was like, if you just look at the name, impact fee, it's supposed to pay for the impacts. And anybody who's been in any of these drilling areas knows that when the trucks first came into town, bringing the water and the sand and all the infrastructure needed to drill these wells, they were just tearing up the roads, tearing up the sides of the roads, taking out people's, occasionally taking out a fence or two. So this was really a way to kind of make these communities whole. And I think, you know, sort of the shocking thing, or the sort of the headline that people are going to see is that, hey guys, this isn't really repairing roads, a bouncy castle, American Idol. That's probably not where we want this money to go.
Well, this is interesting. Says Reid, you just mentioned a couple of the very direct impacts. You know, roads crumbling, just breaking down. They weren't meant to handle some of these heavy trucks and the repetition of those trucks on those roadways, and any, of course, direct environmental impact. But then you did have sort of the related impacts, because you have more people coming in. That's going to drive up the cost of housing for the residents. And also the potential for more crime. So Marie, at least those 13 that you met, some of what you mentioned, they do seem to be somewhat well thought out of the indirect impact.
Yeah, and you know, if you read down the list of the 13 ways you can spend the money, it just it seems pretty clear and reasonable. But when you get into it, it is kind of murky because, for example, I called North Strabane Township, Washington County, and talked to their manager, and I said, you know, hey, what was this all about with the bouncy house and the American Idol contestant? And he said, you know, that was the first year we got the money. It's an annual community event we have. We do it every year. We've done it for two decades. And we felt that, you know, if you look at the list of ways you can spend the money under environmental programs, it says parks and recreation. So he said we felt like that was parks and recreation, and our solicitor agreed. He says in hindsight, you know, he probably wouldn't have done it again. And he said they didn't do it again. They now spend it on fire preparedness and road projects. But he kind of agreed with the Auditor General's main point, which is there is a real lack of clarity for local governments. And, you know, the Auditor General said they're all interpreting this their own way. And, you know, again, what does parks and recreation mean? You know, maybe it can pay for your annual community party.
So they can, while they're not doing it anymore, they can now just use their general operating funds for the bouncy
sure.
house.
Yeah.
Okay. So I want to get a sense, though, the impact fee and Washington County, I believe, does that Washington County still get the most money from the impact fee? I know for a while there they did.
I haven't looked at the latest numbers, but if they're not the top, they're right there neck and neck with some other county, Bradford.
Yeah, they're among the highest because it's based on how many wells you have in your community. So I don't have the numbers in front of me either, but they're among the highest.
But we do know one thing. Numbers, as far as total revenues distributed, have been going down. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's been going down. You know, there's just a lot fewer drilling operations going on these days as opposed to a couple years ago. And that's almost entirely driven by the price of gas that producers are getting. The prices have fallen so low because of high supply driven, you know, mainly by the fracking boom here in Pennsylvania and other places. But so they just don't have as much of a market to sell the gas. You know, there's a talk that those prices will go up in the future when more pipelines are built in here and other places. But the total impact fee is down. I don't know, Marie, if you know the exact numbers this year, but it was over $200 million a few years ago, and now it's definitely under $200 million these days.
Yeah, it's dipped above and below $200 million. And over the years, collectively, it's been over $1 billion. So it's, you know, not a small amount of money, but it does fluctuate based on what's going on in the drilling industry.
And I guess to put that in perspective, the state budget is something in the neighborhood of $30 billion. So we're talking less than 1% of the state budget.
But, you know, I'm wondering, though, if this goes down, and I believe the last numbers I saw from 2015 were $188 million. I'm wondering, you know, do these counties start counting on that? And as their chunk of it goes down, whether, you know, hold it, we have to do some more planning because we were counting on these dollars, and now there's not quite as much this year as it was last year.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question, and it's kind of a question a lot of resource-rich states face is what to do with your budget when a lot of it depends on very volatile sources like a tax on mineral extraction, like oil and gas. You know, Alaska and Wyoming, I was just looking up a statistic, they have some of the most highly volatile budgets in any state in America because they get, of course, they get a lot of their income from oil and gas and other mineral extraction. And so what some of these states do is they put their money into a rainy day fund. When the sun is shining, you make hay to store it up for later. Pennsylvania, on the other hand, has a very steady, historically steady budget because we kind of know where all our money's going to come from year to year. And so maybe we don't have that kind of mindset yet. Maybe we'll start saving up soon.
Marie, one more question about the impact fee audit. And you mentioned when you covered the Auditor General's news briefing, a lack of clarity. So is he calling for anything specifically to be done to the law, the 2012 law?
Yeah, he would like the legislature to revisit it and basically bring more clarity to those spending categories because they are broad in some sense. Like we mentioned, parks and recreation, what does that mean? He also believes that the way the law sets it up is that the State Public Utility Commission, or PUC, collects all the money from oil and gas companies and then distributes it to local governments. But the PUC doesn't have any auditing authority or any mechanisms to crack down on problems. It's kind of a toothless agency here. And he would like to see either them get more power or give that power to another state agency that could just keep better oversight of this.
Okay. We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to get to something the DEP announced yesterday, taking steps to curb harmful air emissions from natural gas sites. DEP spokesman Neil Shader says the department will soon issue two new draft permits and make them available for public comment.
One is a revision to a general permit, another is a new general permit. And these two general permits are for compressor stations for natural gas pipelines and for well construction standards for natural gas wells.
Okay, so a little more detail, Marie and Reed. What does this cover? How long of a process do the public have to comment on these suggestions, et cetera?
Right. Well, this is dealing, a lot of it's dealing with methane emissions. And just to back up for folks, natural gas is a much cleaner burning fossil fuel when you burn it compared to coal, for example. But if it is mainly made up of methane, and if you're releasing that throughout, methane leaks throughout the entire process of drilling, transporting, processing gas. You could be, if you're leaking too much, you could be really undermining the climate benefits you're getting from, you know, a cleaner burning fossil fuel like gas. So this is basically the DEP's, it's the state's first attempt to kind of regulate and crack down on methane emissions. And Governor Wolf announced that they were going to be doing this earlier this year. So they've released these two draft permits. They're trying to get, you know, better leak detection and repairs, more inspections, crack down on noise from compressor stations, which process gas. So it's just, it's kind of their rollout of like the first example of what they're going to be doing along these lines.
And it's kind of a continuation of what we've seen from federal and state agencies in the last few years. A few years ago, the EPA implemented what are known as volatile organic compound standards for oil and gas, for new oil and gas wells. And that's basically a lot of the same stuff. You're trying to make sure the stuff stays in the pipes, doesn't get into the air so people are breathing it, or the emissions are going into the atmosphere. And you know, as Marie said, methane is a powerful greenhouse gas. So this is, and earlier this year, EPA released rules for new oil and gas wells specifically for methane. And those rules are now part of a lawsuit. A lot of states have sued over this. Their future, let's just say, is unclear with the new administration coming in. But all of which is to say is there's a lot of emphasis now by the regulators on, you know, getting the best technology available on these sites.
Final quick question, and that is this strictly an executive branch action, the DEP, or can the legislature have some sort of influence? Marie, do you know?
Well, the legislature has already tried to undermine this effort. There have been proposals to basically say Pennsylvania cannot have methane regulations that are stronger than the federal regulations. So there's already an effort to, you know, roll this back. Although, you know, yes, it is an executive level action. The Wolf administration said that they care about combating climate change and this is important. But certainly the legislature could try to step in.
Just very, very quickly, each of you, what's on your plate? What stories are you working on, Reid?
Well, a lot of what we're working on at the Allegheny front is trying to pick apart and diagnose and understand what's going to happen with the new Trump administration coming in, what it means for environmental laws, what it means for resource development. I'm working on a piece trying to focus on coal country, see what the reaction is there and what the expectations are.
And Marie?
Yeah, I think that's really the big story right now because the federal government appears poised to be doing a total 180 on a lot of energy and environmental initiatives. Trump has said he's, you know, planning to roll back a lot of the things the Obama administration's doing. So, you know, since we focus a lot on state policy as well, we'll be watching, you know, what the state does and how it relates to some of the changes that will likely happen at the federal government.
Marie Cusick is a reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania. Reed Frazier is a reporter for the Allegheny Front. Weekly program heard Saturdays on WESA. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Legionella outbreak at the VA Pittsburgh Hospital that led to the deaths of six patients was 5 years ago. But new information about the investigation has been uncovered. That's next on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together. Coming up, we'll reflect on the big news 75 years ago, the attack on Pearl Harbor. But first, in June, Legionella bacteria was discovered in the water system at Allegheny General Hospital. In late August, Legionella was discovered in the water system of the medical building at the State Correctional Institution, Pittsburgh. It was just about 5 years ago that a Legionella outbreak began at the VA Pittsburgh Hospital. It was determined that during the outbreak, 22 patients were likely infected. Six died. The outbreak ended in 2012. An investigation was launched. Lawsuits were filed. But there's been some information has been uncovered by our next guest. Sean Hamill is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome back, Sean. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, Sean, I mentioned a few of the details related to the outbreak, but briefly remind us of some of the other key facts, including the CDC investigation that I believe began in November of 2012.
It did. The outbreak itself occurred between 2011 and 2012. The first victim was in July of 2011. The last victim who died was near the end of November 2012. But and the VA had been trying to figure out what was going on for the better part of a year. They seemed befuddled. And we know this from emails that we had obtained all the way back in 2013. We did a Freedom of Information Act request with the VA, got these emails really quickly, within months. And so we were able to kind of figure out what happened with the VA, how they proceeded, how they figured out or didn't what was going on. And the end result of that was they asked the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, a federal agency, to come in and help them figure out what was going on, because they had a long, long history of success in fighting Legionella, primarily because they had two of the world's most prominent researchers in Legionnaires' disease, two researchers named Victor Yu and Janet Stout. They worked there for almost 30 years together and are credited with many of the most important discoveries about Legionnaires' disease, how it functions, where it comes from, how to prevent it. And back in the early 90s, one of the things they started to try out there was preventing it from spreading in water, which is how Legionnaires get spread, and it becomes a pneumonia when you get it into your lungs. They experimented with what they call a copper-silver ionization system. And what that is simply a bar of combined copper and silver that they throw electrodes into, and it kicks off minute particles of copper and silver, which they believed, and people who manufactured these machines believed, would kill Legionella. And after years of adapting it to their system, they found success. They managed to prevent any hospital-acquired Legionnaires' disease cases from occurring there for a long time, until they left in 2006, which is another long story. But so we come forward to 2011. People start getting infected. People start dying. The VA is concerned. They say, hey, CDC, come in and help us figure out what's going on. We've had this system that works so well for so long. We're not sure what the problem is.
And in the end, the system, the copper-silver ionization disinfection system, was blamed.
That was the very first thing they said in the very first press release from the VA, and that was pushed by the CDC. And at the time, Victor Yu and Janet Stout had told us that there was a long history between them and the CDC over the use of copper-silver systems. The CDC has long favored simple what they like to refer to as simple chlorine. Just put a lot of chlorine into the water. It'll kill the Legionella. They don't disagree with that, but they say there are advantages and disadvantages to it. So they favored the copper silver. They put it in other places. But they also like other systems too. And the CDC came in and said, no, no, no. In this case, the copper silver system failed. Why they believe that and why it failed was never clear.
And that's what led to your ongoing investigation, the lead for FOIAs to get more information. Right. Do you know how prevalent the copper silver system is?
In hospitals that have a Legionella problem in their water around the country, I'm told by the researchers, but also the manufacturers, that it is the most prevalent form of controlling it once you realize you have Legionella. And an example of that, you mentioned Kane, Allegheny County. When they discovered that they had had Legionella and that a patient had become infected from it recently, they installed a copper-silver system. And they said the reason they did that was in consultation with experts.
Okay. So we only have a few more minutes left. So it took you literally years to get some information.
It did.
What was the question that you needed to have answered that you didn't think was answered?
Well, the same time we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the VA, I filed one with the CDC asking them for the same thing, emails, everything related to this. I want to know how the CDC proceeded, because their final report that they gave to Congress in early 2013 blamed the system. Their report later in 2015 that they put in a journal blamed the system. That disagreed with what we had found talking to people who worked and used to work in the VA, and that disagreed with an inspector general's report. So I wanted to know, why did they come to such a different conclusion, and would there be anything in the emails that gave us that indication? And the first thing you'll find in the emails that we have in a story that starts on Sunday and continues in a part two on Monday, the very first email about this that they gave me from early November 2012, a top official, a chief of the respiratory diseases branch, which includes Legionnaires,
right,
responds immediately when she hears that there's a request from the VA in Pittsburgh. Her first response is, wait a second, isn't that Victor Yu and Janet Stout's hospital? Immediately. And then she goes on to write in another email just minutes later that because Victor Yu and Janet Stout were involved in this or used to be involved in this hospital, and because they had supported Copper Silver, that doing this investigation will have a bit of poetic justice to it. And that was the first email I read in the batch that I only got in August. It took us 3.5 years to get it. And they told me that that just took that long because it fell through the cracks. But when you see these emails and you see our stories, I think other people might wonder why it took 3.5 years to give us these emails. It brings a lot of questions up, and I hope that we at least pose the question clearly to our readers and to others to connect the emails to what happened in their public reports.
And just about 30 seconds left, Sean. Fascinating. CDC respond to you for this story?
They did initially. They put a non-senior level epidemiologist or microbiologist on the phone with me to explain one part of what I was asking about. But when I started asking directly about some of the other emails, they cut us off, and we haven't had a response from them since.
Sean Hamill is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. You can read his complete report on this new information about the Legionella outbreak at the VA Pittsburgh Hospital that happened 5 years ago in Sunday's Post-Gazette and part two on Monday. Sean, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
He pulled out of the dive, and I thought he dropped his landing gear. Something fell. There was other planes around, but they were in the periphery more. You know. But this one dropped something, and it hit the giant hangar behind me, where the PBYs were cared for, attended, and repaired. And it just destroyed it.
Each year, the ranks of the survivors of the attack on Pearl Harbor thin even more. Wednesday marked the 75th anniversary of the attack. 25 years ago, for the 50th anniversary, I spoke to some of the members of the Pennsylvania chapter of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association to hear their recollections of that fateful day. Paul Moyer of Quakertown was a 19-year-old private first class in the 21st Infantry. His unit had just returned from weeks of maneuvers December 6th.
We were all given passes for that Saturday night. Go downtown Honolulu, do your usual thing. And, well, then Sunday morning, of course, all hell broke loose.
We were down below decks because, well, it was early in the morning. We just got through with breakfast. And we had a little lull between to get dressed to go to aboard the Oklahoma for church service. It was just about time for colors at 7:55 is when they struck.
Ted Wozniak of Scott Township was a seaman first class on the battleship Maryland.
Since the USS Oklahoma was outboard of us, she took all the torpedoes and she capsized within minutes. That left the port side of the battleship that I was on for us to fire our guns at the incoming planes. We took two bomb hits, one in the stern and one in the forecastle. And the one in the forecastle went down through all the decks and blew a hole in the side. So we sunk down in the mud, too.
Joseph Messner of Pittsburgh was 19 years old. He was a radio operator on the tender ship Avocet in the middle of Battleship Row.
Those battleships were blazing, burning, and exploding, lying on the bottom because of the Japanese bombing on December 7th. And my little ship, the brave Avocet, went amongst them to put the fires out.
The Japanese attack was over in less than 2 hours.
Now, later in that day, my knees began to shake, totally involuntarily. I thought I was going to collapse because my legs simply would not hold me up. My knees were shaking so badly that I would try to mentally make them stop, but I couldn't do it. The realization of what had taken place suddenly dawned on me. The death and destruction, the fires that were burning all around us.
2,403 Americans were killed, 1,178 wounded, 19 ships, including all 8 battleships, were sunk or heavily damaged.
Ironically, I was killed.
Paul Moyer.
My records got messed up somehow, and somehow or another the word got back here to my dad that I had been killed on December the 7th, and it was a couple months after that until I wrote to him. I never knew he got that telegram until I was allowed to write to him and told him different. And then in 1945, when I got out, I walked up to the school that I went to here right outside of Lansdale in Culpsville, Pennsylvania, and I walked in the principal's office, and I said to him, "What's that gold star doing in back of my name?" He turned just as white as a sheet, and he says, "Well, you're supposed to be dead." I said, "Thanks a lot." I said, "I know you never liked me while I was in school, but was I that bad?"
Paul Moyer passed away in 2011 at age 89. Joe Messner and Ted Wozniak died in 2006 and 2009 at 83 and 90 years old, respectively. The National Pearl Harbor's Survivors Association disbanded in 2011, so it's difficult to determine how many survivors are still alive. According to Todd DiPastino of the Veterans Breakfast Club in Pittsburgh, there are at least 2 survivors living in the Pittsburgh area, Alex Diga in the North Hills and Frank Regina in Monroeville.
Let's remember Pearl Harbor as we go to meet the foe. Let's remember Pearl.
And for this week, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley. Production assistance comes from Vince Balestrino. The producer of The Confluence is Marcus Charleston. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, I hope you have a good week of good news.